Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is November 9, 2022. This panel of the court today has six cases on its agenda, four of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument based solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A22-957, In Re the Estate of Wade Scott Carlson. As counsel likely know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. So, appellant's counsel, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself and your client, and you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matt Kostelnik, and I'm the attorney on behalf of the appellant, Brian Carlson. Brian Carlson petitioned the trial court to appoint a special administrator to secure the proper administration of the estate of the decedent, Wade Scott Carlson, and preserve its assets. The trial court, after a two-day bench trial, denied the petition. In denying the petition, the trial court based its decision on a time-barred 1984 will that devises all of decedent's property to the respondent, Nancy Flatgard. In so doing, the trial court was able to overlook respondent's arguable violations of her fiduciary duty to the decedent that occurred when she used powers of attorney to transfer hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property from decedent to herself. The respondent had the decedent execute these powers of attorney when he was incapacitated following a debilitating stroke that literally left him speechless. The trial court characterized these transfers as problematic because, as the court determined, the decedent's physical and mental condition following the stroke meant that he did not have the capacity to enter into the powers of attorney. And the respondent's use of the powers of attorney exceeded the gift limit in place at the time, $10,000.
Counsel, I mean, I understand the trial court, you know, called those problematic and, you know, there were these gaps in time, but doesn't this case really turn on whether the trial court appropriately considered the 1984 will under Minnesota Statute 524.3-102, I think it is, that, you know, exception, where there are two prongs to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because if the trial court properly admitted that during the trial as a devise, then, you know, then wouldn't you agree, if that was properly admitted and relied upon, that, you know, it's not an abuse of discretion to deny the special administrator or the accounting?
So, and I think you're right. This case, and actually the reason for the appeal, does turn on the trial court's use and characterization of that 1984 will. And the reason why it turns on that characterization is that because under Minnesota law, after 3 years of the decedent's death, that will becomes time barred. So what the statutes say is that it actually can't be admitted to probate as evidence of transfer of property. But Your Honor is zeroing in on the language that says, but it can be used as evidence of a devise. But I don't think, and our argument is that that evidence of a devise language doesn't allow the trial court or anybody to make an end around the three-year prohibition. Instead, the way the Minnesota legislature laid out the transfer of property in a scenario such as this, after a decedent has died and there's a late discovered will and it's after 3 years and it ordinarily would be time barred, is that the statute says that that needs to be, there's two methods. One, appointment of a special administrator, because the special administrator, the statute says there is no repose or limitations period as it relates to appointment of a special administrator, or a petition of determination of dissent. And again, the statute says that can be brought at any time. So our argument, and I see you've got a question, is that the special administrator should have been appointed, and, oh, by the way, a petition of determination of dissent could have been initiated to determine the transfer of property, but that 1984 will, while use of evidence of a device, can't, as the trial court did, be used to be the means of justifying transfers of the decedent's entire estate.
And I keep coming back to, why not? Because when I look at those two prongs of the kind of the exception, you know, one, well, there hadn't been a court proceeding, formal or informal, concerning the succession or administration of the estate. And then second, the trial court says, well, that's satisfied because that respondent here possessed the property devised in accordance with the will. So I keep coming, I mean, I understand what you're saying. There's no, you know, statute of limitations on kind of appointment of special administrator or, you know, the other things, but that's discretionary with the trial court, and it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion if the provisions of the exception were met. And that's why I keep coming back to, why was the trial court wrong?
Our point is that as a matter of interpretation of that provision, it has to mean something other than, in all cases of a time-barred will, this evidence of a devised language can justify post hoc transfers of property. And again, it allowed the court to sort of sidestep the powers of attorney that A, it deemed problematic, and B, only transferred a portion of the estate. So even if we suggest that those powers of attorney were okay, which the trial court didn't, but even if we say those powers of attorney were okay, they only transferred three specific parcels of real property. The rest of the estate remains. And so for the respondent in this case to be in possession of the decedent's entire estate, one must construe that 1984 will as being valid. And indeed, that's exactly what the court did. And we're saying that it went a step too far. It not only considered the will to be evidence of a devise, but it used that devise language in the will to actually affect the transfer of property. And indeed, in the court's amended findings, it said the first issue in this case is whether the 1984 will controls the distribution of the decedent's estate. Well, if that's the first issue, and the court did find that it did control the distribution of the estate, then there is, in fact, in essence, no time bar to the 3 years, the provision in the statute that says the probate proceeding must be commenced within 3 years of the decedent's death. It in essence sort of allows the trial court to backdoor, reverse engineer, justify after the fact these transfers of property when the legislature very, very clearly said either A, within 3 years is a probate, after 3 years is a petition for determination of dissent or a special administrator.
So the statutory interpretation question before us then is whether or not that exception, also fulfilling that exception, creates an exception to the three-year probate.
Correct. And our point is that it would be an exception that swallows the rule if, in fact, it can be used in the same way that the trial court did here. Again, we take no issue with the execution surrounding the 1984 will, that it's a self-proved will, that in fact had the self-proved will names the respondent as the administrator, as the personal representative, and had that been probated within 3 years, we probably wouldn't be here today, but we weren't. And so then consequently, appellant filed a petition for appointment of a special administrator to, as the statute says, identify and secure the assets and properly administer the estate. That was denied in large part on this 1984 will and what we think is a misreading of the statute that then creates this exception that swallows the rule and allows the trial court to do an end run around the three-year prohibition.
So in the absence of that will, then what is the, what law governs or what governs the disposition of the assets?
Thank you. And
in your view,
we think that in a petition for determination of dissent proceeding, that's something that could be brought by a special administrator. We think that while true that the 1984 will could be used as an evidence of a devise, that the petition for determination of dissent proceeding, if brought by a special administrator, is a mechanism by which due process could occur, notice to all interested persons could occur, discovery could occur. One of the issues we ran into at the trial court level was that attorney-client privilege had been asserted in relation to a attorney file that had done state planning work for the decedent and had withheld documents, and a special administrator could have waived that privilege, and in fact could have done things like an accounting to attempt to identify assets and any number of things. And Your Honor's point, and I think what I've grappled with here is that in the end, it's quite possible that the outcome may not be any different, that the respondent may well wind up in the situation as having received the entirety of the decedent's estate. The evidence of a devise could be one of the factors within that. But the point is that at least due process would have been followed.
So doesn't your interpretation of the statute sort of encourage a party to sandbag, sit back and wait in order to, you know, wait 3 years and then improve one's position?
I suppose it could, but the difference is that here the party who is making the petition for appointment of a special administrator and suggesting that a petition for determination of dissent is appropriate isn't the same party who was in control of the 1984 will. It was, in fact, the person in control of the 1984 will was at all times the respondent. And so if that person were coming before the court and saying, well, yeah, I know I had possession of this 1984 will, but I forgot about it.
But your client was in a position to commence some sort of probate action, I mean, shortly after the death, correct?
Well, what's interesting about that, and that's one of the reasons why we think that trial court's findings are problematic, is that the same testimony, and we had the appellant, Brian Carlson, and his two daughters, who were nieces of the decedent, testify about conversations they had with the respondent in 2009, wherein at which time the respondent said, well, yeah, I have possession of a will, but I'm not going to give it to you. I'll do what the decedent's wishes were, and when the appropriate time arrives, I'll distribute out those assets to the beneficiaries. And our point was that didn't happen in 2020. The respondent refused to distribute out the assets, and then that was the precipitating factor in the appellant's commencement of the petition for a special administrator. What we're troubled with at the trial court level is that the trial court said, well, I don't find that testimony credible on the one hand, but then on the other hand, in connection with the claims that the trial court analyzed, suggesting that a special administrator could make breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, setting aside title, et cetera, the trial court used that same testimony to suggest that that was the moment that the statute of limitations was triggered, and therefore those claims that a special administrator could bring were time barred. And so our point is that and in fact, you know, in the equitable estoppel argument where we said, well, the reason why we didn't do anything was because of what we were told back in 2009, the court said, well, but there's no credible evidence of a misrepresentation, keeping in mind that evidence from 2009 was what the trial court determined was actually the triggering event for the running of the statute of limitations.
I'm sorry, Judge Jessen, before you ask a question, could I just say for the benefit of both counsel, the lights are in the center. I'm not sure if you're aware, if you can see the lights, but the yellow light is on now because there's about 2 minutes left in your initial allotment of time. I should have mentioned at the beginning that if you're using the side lecterns to keep an eye toward the lights. Okay.
Thank you.
Judge Jessen. Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that 2009 conversation, too, because I think that was part, but you probably know this record better than I do, that the district court relied upon that conversation and said, well, and latches, you know, also, you know, your bars, your client's claims, because, you know, you should have known, you know, at least 12 years ago mm-hmm. That there was these issues and you waited too long. I mean, is why shouldn't we just be able to affirm the trial court even without getting into the statutory interpretation issues based upon the latches?
Because, great question. And because I think the reason why, in latches, again, we raised the equitable estoppel argument. The court said, well, no credible evidence. We said, but that was the same evidence that you said triggered the running of statute of limitations. And to answer your question, I think the reason why the trial court shouldn't have looked, by the way, I think the proper time to have done that would have been after a special administrator was appointed, and a special administrator says, these are the claims I'm going to bring, and then somebody challenged that on Rule 12, and we could properly brief it. Again, that didn't happen. The trial court just said, here's the possible claims, and they're time barred. But let me answer your question. The reason why that's not appropriate is because it, in effect, imposes upon the statute an overlay of a limitations period and a statute of repose that the legislature clearly never intended, because the special administrator statute and the petition for determination of dissent statute says you can bring those at any time. And so that's, in essence, what the trial court was saying is that, well, I know it says you can bring them at any time, but this was just too much time, and therefore I'm going to consider this all time barred, and you should have brought it before anyway. And our point is actually that the statute deliberately says here's what the time bar is for probate, but that doesn't apply to petition determination dissent. That doesn't apply to special admin. And that has to mean something. It has to mean that you can bring those at any time. And there is no artificial overlay of a repose period that after which time you simply are flat out barred. Had that been the case, the legislature would have said so.
I have one more question. So the district court reasoned, I think I'm looking at page 19 of the order. You may or may not need to look at it, but because the 1984 will controls basically any, I'm reading now, any alleged abuse of power of the power of attorney was harmless, you know, on the ground that it all would have gone to her anyway. I guess I'm unclear. Are you challenging that part of the district court's reasoning? In other words, if you accept for the moment that the district court is correct in saying the 1984 will controls, would you agree then that but there's really no need for a special administrator to look into the matter because it would lead to the same result?
Oh, yes, and we think there's error, legal error, in that statement. But if the Court of Appeals deems the trial court correct in suggesting that the 1984 will controls the distribution of property, then it probably would trump the issues surrounding the powers of attorney that the court deemed problematic. It would in essence moot them. I think in theory there could be claims there, but yeah. Let's face it, the entire state. Our point is that's evidence that the trial court erroneously construed the 1984 will to in effect probate it, even though it put a different label on it and called it evidence of a devise.
Yeah.
We think it's evidence that it actually was being used to distribute property when it shouldn't have.
District court said harmless, you say moot. I think the principle is the same, I think you're talking about the same thing. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, just because it's not right doesn't mean that there's necessarily a remedy in this scenario, and that would be the unfortunate reality that we'd be stuck with if, in fact, that were the interpretation were deemed to be correct.
Thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kim Ruckdashel Haley, and I represent respondent Nancy Flatgard in this matter. On behalf of Ms. Flatgard, I would respectfully request that the Court of Appeals affirm the decision of the trial court, because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's request for a special administrator, for injunctive relief, and for an accounting, and in further, in its May 6, 2022 order, determining that there was no proper basis for amended findings, other than the language where the judge did, in fact, tweak its language to avoid any confusion, and determined that there wasn't a proper basis for a new trial. I'm just going to provide a few what I think to be significant facts for the court's consideration as an overview. Now, appellant and respondent are the only siblings of the decedent Wade Scott Carlson in this matter. Appellant is a retired attorney, and my client respondent, Nancy Flatgard, is a retired nurse. She now is in a nursing home. She's been there for a few years. And as the trial court determined, she was sincere, but she suffers from some dementia and memory loss. In 1984, it's undisputed, as counsel has communicated, that the decedent executed a self-proved will. They don't dispute it. It's there. It's a self-proved will under the statute, leaving everything to my client, the respondent here, and naming her as the executor. Substantial evidence at trial showed that the decedent and respondent, his sister, were very close throughout the years, and that this continued all the way up until the decedent's death in 2008. Decedent and my client even lived in the same house up until 2001, when the decedent did have a debilitating stroke. Now, at that time, the stroke made it such that he could no longer live in the home, and he ultimately went and resided in different long-time care facilities. There were rehabilitation efforts meant, significant ones, and we showed evidence of that at trial. And both the decedent and my client wanted him to come home, but unfortunately, he could not progress to a level where he ever got home. Now, appellant makes much of these real estate transactions that occurred back in 2001. And let's realize these are transactions that are recorded, right? And so they're a matter of public record. But they're real estate transactions that occurred in 2001 when real estate of the decedent was transferred via power of attorneys from the decedent to my client. Specifically, however, what is really ignored here by the appellant is the good faith of my client in all of this. The real estate was transferred back in 2001 through a very highly qualified attorney, an estate attorney, who helped the decedent at that time after his stroke with medical assistance. And work that needed to be done in connection with medical assistance and his own planning. And so specifically, attorney Chris Mayer of the law firm Mazur Amundsen Boggio assisted the decedent to do medical assistance planning, and for the respondents, who it's undisputed had a close relationship with the decedent, for her to become his power of attorney. Consistent with the direction of the attorney and with what decedent wanted, my client became the power of attorney through the decedent's execution of a power of attorney general form in April of 2001 and a short form power of attorney in May of 2001. She, my client, continued to serve as that power of attorney from 2001 all the way through 2008, when the decedent passed.
So, now, if I may,
yeah,
just ask you a specific question, which I think does relate to the facts that are in the record. The trial court said, this may have been in the order granting in part, denying in part, the motion for amended findings. The trial court says that the 1984 will was among the extensive evidence and conclusions supporting the denial of the petition. So if we agreed with appellant that 1984 will was improperly utilized as evidence here, what are the other big pieces of evidence that we should be looking at to determine, because it's still an abuse of discretion standard, did the trial court abuse its discretion if, and I understand you don't agree with this position, but if the 84 will was not properly considered?
Yeah, thank you. I think that raises a very good point. Obviously, I disagree wholly
with the interpretation
of the statute and the will issue. Let's say the will wasn't there.
That's what I'm asking.
Yes. Then there was substantial evidence at trial through various witnesses, including my client, Nancy Flatgard, her daughter, Tina Kay, And also, and very significantly, a gentleman by the name of James Orenstein. Mr. Orenstein was a longtime CPA for the decedent, very close friend. And in fact, he testified that he saw the decedent on nearly a daily basis. The judge found the evidence and testimony of Mr. Orenstein, who had no financial interest in this case whatsoever, to be highly credible. And Mr. Orenstein testified various things. One, that the decedent loved the respondent, that the decedent wanted all of his assets to go to the respondent, that based on his communications with the decedent, he understood that the 1984 will was, in fact, the will of the decedent, and there wasn't anything else. And that, significantly, the decedent absolutely despised the appellant, his brother, Brian Carlson. And at trial, Mr. Carlson did not deny that. In fact, he admitted it and said, I acknowledge that he despised me over the years, although he said at the end they had made some kind of amends. So we have testimony of witnesses, including Mr. Orenstein and others, who support the fact that the respondent was properly in possession of the decedent's assets and that the decedent wanted this to occur and that this started way back in 2001 all the way through decedent's death.
So we're getting to kind of evidence that you believe would support the the intention of the decedent, which is one of the things we're supposed to, the probate judge should be looking for. Okay.
I think it is significant, too, when you're looking at the, what the trial court did, that the trial court didn't just base the trial court's decision on a will, but also all this other substantial evidence to show why it is that the respondent was properly in possession of the decedent's assets over all of these years. But the court also had an other independent basis to determine that the appellant's petition should be denied, getting into the whole issue of latches that there was a discussion about earlier. That is a separate independent basis that the trial court determined that the appellant's petition should be denied. And there's a lot of facts and testimony that go to that, going all the way back to 2001, when there are recordings of the real estate being transferred, to this conversation that purportedly took place in which the petitioner or the appellant here claims that my client said, oh, there is a will, but I won't give it to you. And if you look in the petition itself, the appellant says that this same denial of not giving you that will continued over the years. So he knew right in his own petition, you can tell from the language that he knew there was a will that my client, he says, wouldn't give it to him. And he could have done something, but he chose not to. Other testimony at trial, including of his daughters, was that way back when, in that 2008-2009 time frame, his daughters wanted property of the decedent, and my client, according to their testimony, refused to provide it over the years. Again, more evidence going backward in time, and when you raise the question of, couldn't the appellant have brought a case years ago? Absolutely he could. And that's what the trial court determined as well, based upon substantial evidence before the court that the appellant sat on his hands. He did nothing, and he could have. And for that separate independent reason, two, the trial court determined that the appellant hadn't met his burden to show that there was any need for a special administrator in this case. Another separate independent.
If a special administrator is appointed, are there any limits in the law about how far back in time the special administrator may inquire in determining, you know, the estate? I mean, I'm just wondering if there's a certain defined look back period or if it's unlimited.
You know, that's a good question. I don't think there's a limitation period for when a special administrator could be appointed. So you could wait a long time and appoint one. However, that special administrator, in determining to go after someone, in this case his own sister, There would be limitations on the claims that could be brought based on statute of limitations. So, for example, with respect to the appellant's claim here that there should be an accounting, there's a 6-year limitations period that applies. I know I've cited the statute 541.05, subdivision 1, says there's 6-year limitations period for an accounting. That has long expired. So that's the type of claim that a special administrator, if one were appointed, couldn't pursue, nor could the...
So does that mean that the special administrator would only look back 6 years from before either the date of the appointment or the date of death? Or how does that apply in this context?
Well, I think it applies to the nature of the claims that a special administrator could bring. In this instance, the trial court appropriately determined that the types of claims a special administrator could bring, potentially, which doesn't make sense to bring when everything was properly devised to my client to begin with, but let's say that there was a reason to go after my client. Those kinds of claims would be long barred based upon the knowledge of acts going way back in time to 2008, breach of fiduciary duty, requesting an accounting, those kind of things would just simply be long past. It would make no sense to appoint a special administrator for that separate independent basis as well.
So just to be, if I can be clear about, so in other words, if there were a special administrator, let's say doing work in 2023 in that year, he or she, and if he or she was trying to bring a claim against your client, then any claim could only, the actual claims would only go back 6 years to, say, 2017. So in other words, any conduct by your client before 2017 would be time barred? Is that the way it would apply?
I would look more.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to understand.
Yes, thank you. When you look at the events when decedent passed in 2008 and the purported conversation that the appellant said he had with my client in refusing to provide property and in refusing to provide the will, that is the time frame which would trigger a limitations period. So if you're looking at an accounting period, for example, a 6-year time frame would run from 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, all the way to 2015. Or a limitations period for breach of fiduciary duty, again, would run through that same time frame. To wait and sit on his hands...
Yeah, so that's the time period to bring a valid claim. So in 2023, I suppose, one could bring a valid... If there were any cause of actions that accrued between 2017 and 23, it's another way of stating maybe the same thing, but...
Yeah. So I think any limitations period for potential claims, to the extent they would exist, would have long expired prior to the time when Mr. Carlson brought his petition.
I interrupted Judge Jessen with a question.
I just had a quick final question. So is there any case law that you have found that deals with the application of latches in response to a petition for a special administrator?
As far as latches and a special administrator, I would have to go back and look at our brief. I don't recall any particular case on hand right now. But I think it is important to kind of circle back, if I could, for just a minute, on the significance of the will.
And just so you know, your time has expired, but you may sum up in the way that you're intending to do. Go ahead.
It's significant.
And especially if you wish to respond to Judge Jessen's question, but please feel free to answer the question fully.
Yeah, I will just wrap up by saying it's significant, the fact that my client is not using and never has used the 1984 will as a sword or to transfer assets to her. Rather, when this claim is brought against her, she has used the will and subsequent testimony and exhibits to show that she was properly in possession of the assets and that, his effort to somehow 20 years later, 12 years later, take assets from her makes no sense, and she had to defend herself in this case. For all these reasons, we would respectfully request that the trial court's decisions be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll take the last issue first. And so at trial, before this issue was briefed post-trial, evidence of devise and what it means, the respondent took a very different position. And in arguing in support of a motion in limine on the sword shield analogy that we hear now, in arguing in support of a motion in limine, the argument was made that because of the 1984 will and the will being dispositive, quote, there's no reason for this proceeding to move forward. That's at transcript page 16. Then during trial, when respondent moved to probate the 1984 will, the time-barred 1984 will, the respondent argued that under the 1984 will, quote, everything goes to the respondent. So they were, in fact, attempting to use the 1984 will to transfer property, not to suggest that it's evidence of devise or that the respondent was properly in possession of the property. Second, on the issue...
And those arguments were rejected by the district court?
Yeah, so the trial did go forward,
yeah.
and the trial court took the issue under advisement on the probate, and as you saw, did in fact use the word probate, but then changed the label in response to our post-trial briefing to suggest that it was only evidence of a devise. Our point is elevating form over substance doesn't work, and in fact, we need to look at what the trial court actually did.
Okay.
I also want to talk briefly about the limitations issues. This is exactly the problem with the trial court framing up these causes of action on its own accord without briefing, when they hadn't been brought by a special administrator because a special administrator hadn't been appointed, and then shooting each one down on limitations arguments. It wasn't the proper process by which we would have dealt with that. And to Your Honor's question about, well, do we look back 6 years from 2023, two responses to that. Number one, to the extent that knowledge is a triggering event for any of these, we're sort of assuming that, or we're sort of overlaying the analysis with that, an assumption that the appellant would have been the special administrator. In fact, anybody could have been the special administrator. So you have to think about whether or not the appellant's knowledge or the special administrator's knowledge would apply, and that's why it was premature to make that analysis. But second, I do think the answer to Your Honor's question is written in the statute itself, 524.3-108. That's, of course, the same statute that says that a special administrator can be appointed at any time, even beyond the general 3-year limitations period for, quote, the purpose of reducing assets to possession, administering the same under direction of the court, or making distribution of any residue to the heirs to be entitled thereto pursuant to a descent proceeding. So what the legislature is saying is that this can happen at any time. So we're not constrained by fiduciary duty breaches or quiet title actions. Legislature's saying these powers can be exercised by a special administrator.
But doesn't it have to make a difference? I mean, you're talking about process, and yeah, but to reverse, we'd have to find that it would somehow make a difference. I mean, we're not obligated to say, oh yeah, the proper process wasn't followed here. You know, there's no statute of limitations on appointing a special administrator, but to what end, I guess, is
What would it have made a difference or not? We won't know at this stage because a discovery of the type necessary wouldn't have...
Based on what, though? I mean, the discovery is, here's all the assets, here's the dates they were transferred, here's how they were spent. What difference does that make? I mean, what else is the special administrator going to find?
Sure. Well,
I mean, there are credibility determinations that we're bound by, this court is bound by on review.
I mean, let's take non-probate assets, for example. Like anything that would have passed separate and apart from the will has not been discovered, has not been identified. And I think what the legislature is saying here is that it's so important to properly secure the just administration of an estate that we're going to allow petitions for determination of descent and special administrators to be appointed even beyond the 3-year period. And here we have a person person who died childless, owned his own business for many, many years, had assets, vacation properties in Vermont, accounts, life insurance policies, you name it. Any number of these haven't been dealt with. And what I think the legislator is saying is that we want this to be dealt with appropriately. And as a result, what difference could it make? The special administrator could identify these assets that passed separate and apart from the 1984 will. And the point that appellant was making, and the evidence was kind of gutted, the testimony was gutted in the trial court's order as it relates to evidence put forth by my client and his nieces. But the point my client was attempting to make at trial was not him, that his nieces had a very close relationship with the decedent and were told by the decedent that the decedent intended to pass on portions of his estate to the nieces. And the nieces were shocked and saddened when that didn't happen because they had such a close relationship. So there may well be property that didn't pass through the will that should be discovered. And the legislator is saying that that's very important and we're gonna allow that to happen even after 3 years.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.